Hoo-yah! Welcome to Coach RJ Radio. Hi, this is Ron Jones, Corporate Well Coach, live from Los Angeles in Southern California, where the surf is always up and health is hot. Today's show, Heat Illness Prevention. This is actually a PowerPoint presentation I do for my corporate clients on trying to prevent heat illness and complications. A lot of updates in there with hydration as well, as I have a pretty extensive background in ultra-endurance racing. So I know a lot about the heat. Before I became a corporate well coach, I actually worked out in construction prior to college, and so I know what it's like to be out in the field there with a lot of heat issues. I also do collegiate football fitness coaching, preseason conditioning, so I'm aware of, you know, high metabolic rates and heat and ambient air temperature. I did the Race Across America a couple of times as an athlete and also coached Team Brazil. A lot of extreme heat conditions as we raced across the Mojave Desert in the Midwest, temperatures exceeding 115 degrees. I've also been a ultra race official at the Badwater Ultra Marathon, which the year I was out there was 125. That was a cool day because it actually gets hotter in Death Valley, California. And I've officiated and raced at the Furnace Creek 508 Ultra Endurance Bicycling Race provided by Adventure Corps. So I know a lot about the heat. I've been out in those conditions, and I know you can get in trouble in a hurry. So the objectives today, I'd like to overview major factors of heat illness and prevention. I'd like everyone to understand a little bit about hydration science, at least the basics. And I really hope you respect and use the power of being acclimated to hydration as prevention, because it's one of the most important things you can do is to get used to the heat. And then learn how fitness and exertion and your weight factors into work capacity and heat safety. And of course, your overall health is a big player in this. So moving forward, a little trivia here to start the show. Core temperature. What was the highest human core temperature ever recorded? 110.5, 115.7, or 121.0 Fahrenheit? Actually, it was 115.7 degrees, and that was recorded. You would think maybe it'd be by an ultramarathon runner or a Tour de France cyclist. It was a cook. And what's interesting is they took that temperature about 25 minutes after cooling this guy down. So if you're a cook, be careful, because you can generate a lot of heat in that kitchen. Basic heat terms. Heat illness. What is a heat illness? Well, it's a serious medical condition. It could be cramping, exhaustion, syncope, or stroke. And what is a heat cramp to break that down? It's a more of a mild illness from large fluid and salt loss. It's usually easily treated in the field. Heat exhaustion. That's a little more serious as moderate illness after continued exertion and dehydration and can be accumulative over many days. And I'll explain this a little bit later in the show. And then a heat stroke, of course, that's a serious illness, rapid increase in core temperature beyond the body's ability to control, and it's definitely a medical emergency. So let's look at some environmental risk factors. You know, what's out in the environment that could create an issue for having a heat illness or emergency? Well, obviously the air temperature. It's now spring 2009, so things are heating up here in Southern California and other places around the world. And that's definitely a factor. Humidity. We don't have a lot of humidity here in California in many locations, but if you're back east or in the Midwest in the United States, that's a big problem. Radiant heat from the sun or even metal objects, engines. Many of the people I work with work in an industrial type of setting, so they're around a lot of metal objects and big engines that are creating heat. Other environmental risk factors. Conductive. You get heat from the ground. Wind, if there's no wind, that's a problem because the wind kind of helps pull the heat from your body. And then, of course, exertion and duration. And your clothing and your PPEs, which are personal protective equipment. It could be a certain type of chemical suit some people wear if they're working with hazardous chemicals. It could even be a respirator that limits some of your heat loss through respiration. So all those are environmental risk factors. Here's some environmental references. You know, how hot does it get where? Well, in a sauna, it gets about 160 to 250 degrees. A spa can be about 115 degrees. Death Valley can be as hot as 134. And like I said, I was out there officiating the Badwater Ultra Marathon. It was 125. That's pretty intense. You can definitely get into trouble in minutes out there if you don't know what to do. In Libya, it's 136 in the shade, by the way. And then, of course, in industrial populations, it can get quite warm or very hot depending on what you're doing. You could be inside of a tank vessel or around other equipment that's generating heat. So all those are references to some environmental heat ranges. How do we generate heat, or how is heat generated? It's radiative, so the sun produces heat. We also create heat with our exercise or work, and for the purposes of this, usually I work with industrial populations, but if you're exercising in the gym or you're doing a physical job at work, it's all metabolic work, so it's all the same thing, really. And then external heat generation can be hand warmers, fire, liquids. That's not really the main point today. Energy and heat. Well, when we work our muscles and contract through exertion, this creates a metabolic heat, and then this heat must be transferred out of the body to maintain proper operating temperature. So that's energy and heat. How do we lose this heat? We've generated this heat through work, and now we need to get rid of it. So how do we get rid of that heat? Well, evaporation is the best way to lose heat from the body. As the liquid sweat changes to vapor, we lose a lot of energy that way. It also burns a lot of calories. So that's a good way to lose some weight, is sweating a lot. Of course, the metabolic process of that is that you rev your metabolism up through the work. You're not trying to lose weight just from the sweat, but it does burn a lot of calories. So anyway, evaporation is a great way to lose heat. Conduction. If we're around a cooler object, the heat can transfer out of the body. Convection is when the wind pulls the heat off. Radiation, as the sun goes down, we lose those infrared emissions, and we can lose some heat that way. And then we lose a little bit of heat through respiration. The ambient air takes inner heat and humidity away, provided the air is cooler than the inside of the body. If it's hot outside the body, it'd be a little bit difficult to lose heat into something hotter. Humans and heat toleration. When you look at human beings, we're actually tropical animals that can tolerate high heat very well, provided a few things are in place. One is that we produce enough sweat, so we have to be hydrated to sweat enough and also be acclimated to the heat so we can sweat enough to stay cool. Another big point to tolerate the heat is that the sweat can evaporate, so that's a factor of humidity in clothing. If it's too humid, the ambient air is too wet to take any more moisture. You'll see that back east or the Midwest. Out here in Southern California, it's not really that big of a deal in terms of the humidity, although it can raise a little bit. If people aren't used to the humidity, that can be a factor. There are high school, college football deaths every year, and many times they occur on higher humidity days. So we can do really well if the sweat can evaporate. If we don't have contact with a high heat surface, we can do really well. So if it's really hot outside and you're sitting on a hot metal plate, that's not a good thing. Okay, so again, we can do well if we're not sitting on something hot. And then the last point is your healthy weight and you're fit for the duty that you're performing. So again, health becomes a factor here. The healthier you are, especially with your cardiovascular health, the more able you are to tolerate the heat. So if any of those are not present, your capacity to tolerate heat is decreased. So make sure to adjust accordingly. And to review, you need to produce enough sweat. The sweat needs to be able to evaporate. You can't be sitting on a high heat surface. And healthy weight, fit for duty. These are all important factors for tolerating the heat as human beings. The next slide here is a little bit of trivia. Tissue density facts. Muscle, or fat-free mass, is 70 to 80% water. Fat tissue is 10% water. So the muscle is much more dense than fat. Muscle weighs more than fat, requires more energy than fat to stay alive, and produces more heat than fat. So if you have a lot of muscle in your body, you're a metabolic machine. Next point. Heat illness. What are the risk factors for heat illness? Well, environmental risk are present. We talked about those a little bit earlier. Could be the ambient air temperature, things like that. Other risk factors, dehydration, illness, especially viral illness. If you've had an illness and you come back to work or back into an activity, be really careful that first day or two because you could be dehydrated. You might not be able to tolerate the heat as well. If you've got a coworker or a person on your team that is coming off an illness, keep an eye on them. Use the buddy system. Overexertion is a risk factor. Sleep deprivation. This is really interesting when I looked at the research. And by the way, for this presentation, I think I'm up to 26 or 27 sources, many of them from the American College of Sports Medicine, National Strength and Conditioning Association, organizations like that. But if you're sleep deprived, you're much less able to tolerate the heat. So be careful of how much sleep you're getting, especially during heat waves. If you have poor fitness, you don't tolerate the heat well. If you're not acclimated, you don't tolerate the heat well. And the first 4 days coming into a high heat situation is really the critical period, although it can take a little bit longer, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And drugs, alcohol, and supplements, all those things can be risk factors. If you're taking a prescription drug that's a diuretic, causes you to lose fluid, be careful of that because it could be a risk factor in a high heat situation. Now, I say high heat, but you can also have a heat stroke in the winter. You know, it depends on how much metabolic heat you're creating, how much clothing you have. I'll talk about that as I get into heat strokes in a moment. If you're drinking alcohol, it's a diuretic, and you can lose fluid that way. You come back to work or the activity the next day, and you've been drinking, it could be an issue. And then a lot of the supplements people take today have a diuretic effect or metabolic enhancing effect. Those all affect your ability to tolerate the heat, especially when it's really hot. Be careful of that. Some people are taking all kinds of funky supplements and drinking, you know, multiple energy drinks that have all kinds of herbal, you know, chemicals in them, and this can be a factor, so be careful. Syncope, or heat illness categories, let's look at the four basic: syncope, cramps, exhaustion, and heat strokes. And we'll break these down one at a time. Syncope is a loss of consciousness from low blood pressure, usually due to heat illness issues. So what happens is, as the heat goes up, your blood vessels dilate to your extremities, your arms and legs, and the blood can end up pooling in the lower extremities or the legs. And a lot of times people will pass out from this when they're standing up, not necessarily working. This condition can sometimes be related to a central nervous system malfunction, a metabolic issue, or a cardiovascular problem. One thing you should know about your lower extremities, your legs, is that they have one-way check valves in them. So the blood return isn't optimized unless you move around and work those muscles. And as you work your leg muscles, it kind of pushes that blood uphill, if you will, back up towards your heart and your lungs to recirculate. So people that don't move a lot have more issues with this blood pooling condition. You see that in long plane flights, the Super Bowl, people are sitting all day. Creates a problem with the blood pooling. So movement is good. Once again, it can cause a lot of, it can actually help you with a lot of problems, prevent things, just moving around. The next category is heat cramps. Heat cramps are exertion-induced cramps caused by prolonged exercise and often in the heat, although remember, you can have these heat issues in the winter, depending on how hard you're working. The three key factors usually present are muscle fatigue, fluid loss, and a large sodium loss. Recovery is usually pretty good with heat cramps, often treated in the field. You should gently stretch muscles to full length. Oral ingestion of sodium fluids or food. So it's actually more optimal to drink your fluid to rehydrate and make sure it has enough sodium or salt. Be careful with electrolyte balance with all these heat illness conditions. You don't want to be drinking tons of plain water. I'll get into that in a moment. It can cause some issues. And much more on sodium in a moment, too. Next category, heat exhaustion. So this is a little more serious now. Think of heat exhaustion as a safety brake mechanism provided by the brain to stop working in heat production. So, you know, a lot of times with heat illness and many other things in health, for that matter, people don't listen to their bodies. Your body is telling you something. You need to pay attention. So it's giving you some neurological a braking, if you will, to stop working. If you stop working, you stop producing so much heat. What are the risk factors to get heat exhaustion? Well, dehydration is one. If you have a high BMI, body mass index, basically you have too much body fat, that could be an issue. If the air temperature is high, these are all risk factors, by the way. Wind velocity, remember, if the wind isn't blowing a lot, it can't pull the heat away from your body. If you're not acclimated to high heat conditions, that's a risk factor. And your accumulative exposure is really important. So let's say you come in on day one, you're fairly hydrated, you do okay, but you get dehydrated by the end of the day. And then you come back on day two, and you didn't rehydrate on day one after work or after practice, and then on day two, you're worse. Day three, you're even worse. And then this heat exhaustion can end up going into heat stroke. So be careful of that carryover effect. With recovery, heat exhaustion, usually it's obtained with leg elevation. That helps with blood pressure issues, drinking some oral fluids with sodium, and resting. And on that rest, remember that the recovery period for heat exhaustion, if you get this condition, usually runs about 24 to 48 hours to return to a full duty. So just because you rehydrate and you feel a little bit better in a couple of hours, remember you're not really 100%. It's going to take a day or two to get back to that level. Again, use the buddy system for your coworkers or fellow athletes. Ramping it up here, heat strokes. I say strokes in plural. So here's a question. Do you have to be dehydrated to have a heat stroke? And the answer to that is no. You can have a classic heat stroke from, you know, you see dry skin. That's usually what people think of when we talk about heat stroke. You can also have an exertional heat stroke, where when the person goes down, they're actually sweaty. And I'll break this down here in a second. Most people will stop their metabolic work with a rectal temperature of about 104 degrees. It's important to get a rectal on this because even taking another type of temperature in the ear or through the mouth, you lose some temperature off that reading a little bit. So the EMTs will probably go rectal just to get an accurate reading. But again, most people go down at about 104. This varies. I mean, some people have worked at a much higher degree, like the cook that I used the example of when we started the show. Some trivia on death and heat. Death during heat waves is primarily caused by A, extreme dehydration and heat stroke, B, cardiovascular disease complications, C, lack of cold beer. The answer is actually B. So most deaths in heat waves are caused by cardiovascular disease complications. Next slide, heat stroke, classic dehydration. Let's break that down. This is a non-exertional heat stroke, or can be. So, you know, if you think of someone being stranded in the desert with no water, they're not working very hard, but, you know, they can have a heat stroke. The U.S. Army did an interesting study over 22 years, and they found that 17% of heat stroke hospitalizations had dehydration. So that means all the other people that had heat strokes were hydrated. So again, only 17% of the Army's 22-year study were actually dehydrated. In Israel, they did a soldier study, and they found that 16% of 82 cases were dehydrated. So pretty similar findings here. Most of the people in these two Army studies were hydrated when they had a heat stroke. So that means they're producing a lot of metabolic work really fast, which brings us up to the next heat stroke, the exertional heat stroke. And this is heat created by extreme exertion that outpaces the body's ability to dissipate the heat. Usually when people have a exertional heat stroke, they're running a rectal or actual core temperature of 103 to 105.6. Remember, most people go down at about 104, but that varies by individual. There's a central nervous system dysfunction with an exertional heat stroke. You go into multiple organ system failures. And remember, when people go down with an exertional heat stroke, most of them will have a wet skin that's pale. So they're not dehydrated. They just can't get rid of that high core temperature heat that's been created. A little more on exertional heat stroke. Heat production is 15 to 20 times greater than at rest when you have an exertional heat stroke. 80 to 85% of the blood is directed to active muscles. This decreases blood flow to the gut and limits that heat exchange process. So as you're working really hard, the body sends blood to those extremities, your arms and legs. It decreases blood to the gut, and that decreases the body's ability to lose heat. An important point here is that your core temperature with an exertional heat stroke condition can be raised 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit every 5 minutes if no heat is removed from the body. So if you think about human beings, we operate in a very narrow temperature range optimally. 1.8 degrees every 5 minutes is a lot of heat to generate without being removed. You're basically cooking yourself. So it's a really, it's a very serious situation. Continuing exertional heat stroke. The cell is heated beyond its thermal threshold of 104 degrees. And what happens when the cell goes beyond 104 degrees, the cell wall begins to break down. And the cell is constructed a certain way. It allows certain things to come in and out, but it also keeps, you know, it's very protective in many ways. But if that cell wall breaks down, it just leaks everything out and other things come in that aren't supposed to be in there, and basically it leads to organ failure. Your window for full recovery if you have an exertional heat stroke is about 60 minutes. So you have about 60 minutes to get a person back to their normal body temperature and cognitive function within normal ranges, only about an hour. So I want you to think of seconds and minutes with this condition, not hours. It's really an emergency. You know, you don't have hours to work with when someone has an exertional heat stroke. Just minutes. Signs and symptoms. When someone's having an exertional heat stroke, mentally, they can become disoriented, confused, dizzy, irrational, irritable, and exhibit some pretty unusual behaviors. If you're used to working with a person or playing with a person on your team, you kind of know how they act and behave. If you see them behaving erratically or they're really ticked off, and that's usually not their type of behavior, especially in a heat situation, you know, you might want to take them aside and make sure they're okay. Physically, if they're having an exertional heat stroke, they could have poor balance and muscle function. They could be collapsing, be hyperventilating. They can even start vomiting and have diarrhea, which further complicates the fluid loss situation as well as pH balance problems. They can have a seizure or go into a coma. So again, these are signs and symptoms of exertional heat stroke. I've seen people go into heat exhaustion, not a full-on heat stroke, but just even with heat exhaustion, and they get very combative and very disoriented. And you really need to work quickly when they go into that situation and take command presence and do what needs to be done, because otherwise they can go into heat stroke and it's going to be a bad day, especially on a hike or someplace like that where you're not around medical services immediately. Being acclimated to heat is your best prevention. So let's talk about this a little bit. Heat acclimatization is best known for prevention against environmental heat stroke and heat exhaustion. To acclimate to the heat requires a gradual increase of duration, which is how long you exercise, and intensity, which is how hard you exercise. The research indicates the break-in period is about 4 to 14 days, but this can take 12 weeks of regular work in heat, at least 2 hours per day. If you're an athlete, you know, it could take longer than 14 days because you might be limited to just 2 hours a day, especially with youth athletes because they have shorter practice sessions. If you're an industrial employee out at work, you know, you could be working, you know, 8 to 12 hours a day out in the heat, and so you probably wouldn't need 12 weeks. But I think the take-home point here is that the most critical period is the first 4 days. And when I looked at the research, a lot of the people that died in the collegiate football studies did not die in the first day. They died in the second or third. And why? It was that accumulative effect. When they came into practice, maybe they were dehydrated, maybe they weren't. But the key here is that when they went home, they didn't take care of business. They didn't rehydrate. They didn't recover. They came back the second day in worse shape than the first, and the third day in worse shape than the second. And sometimes this led to death. Completely preventable, by the way. Post-exertion heat storage. So think about creating a lot of heat in your body, and you've had a heat emergency, okay, and your body is storing this heat now. With proper treatment, post-exertion sweat rates and skin blood flow rapidly return to normal. So if you treat a person right after a heat illness or heat emergency situation. On the surface, they look pretty good. But here's an interesting point I found in the research. Only about 53% of the heat stored during 60 minutes of hard exertion will be dissipated after 60 minutes of recovery. Okay, so about half of what you store in an hour is released after working hard 60 minutes to recover. So half of that heat is still inside your body that was stored during that high vigorous activity period. So you really have to think about cooling down the deeper core of the body in these situations. Think of a heat emergency like treating a burn. You basically keep cooking until you're cooled off. So if you have a burn, let's say you fall in a campfire and you pull your arm out and it's burned, even though your arm is out of the fire, the tissue is still burning. So it's really important to get the skin cooled down even though it's away from the source. I think with the heat illnesses, it's the same way. You might take the person out of the heat environment and put them inside an air-conditioned car or pickup, but they've still got a lot of heat stored inside. So what do you do in these emergency situations? Well, the next slide here is heat stroke emergency actions. The top priority is to cool the victim first and then transport. So even before you put them in the ambulance, you've got to think about seconds and minutes and cooling down their inner core temperature. There are three primary ways to do that. The first one is the best way. It's a cold or ice water immersion. There are standards or guidelines out there for sports, and I work with football a lot, so I'll take football as an example. Ideally, if you've got high heat situations, you should have a stock tank out there. It's an animal water trough thing full of ice water. And if someone gets into a heat emergency situation, the best thing to do is just dunk them in the tank, because we're going to try to cool that core temperature as rapidly as possible. I'm not talking about drinking ice water. I'm talking about dunking them, immersion. That's the best way to get their core temperature down in the least amount of time. Many people won't have that option, which brings us to option number two. Use ice water wipes, ice packs, and fanning. It works really well, but it doesn't cool the core temperature quite as fast as the immersion. So let me break this down a little bit. Ice water wipes. If you have a towel and you drop it into your cooler, you wring it out a little bit and start wiping the skin down while someone is fanning the skin. What we're trying to do with this is to get that evaporative process to work. Remember, evaporation is the best way to lose heat without the immersion. Okay, so we're trying to get the evaporation to take place. Have somebody really fanning a lot and just continually wipe down their skin. You can take some ice packs and put them in areas where the blood comes closest to the surface of the skin. That would be around the neck, under the armpits, down in the groin areas. And this happened to me once in the race across America. I think it was 1996. My teammate, Big Joe Peterson, went down in Mojave Desert. We were racing about 115 degrees. He was out there about 30 minutes and collapsed in my arms. We threw him in the van, and we got the ice packs, and we put them in his groin and armpits and started wiping and fanning him down. It took him about 15 minutes, I think, before he even knew who he was or where he was at. So it works pretty well, but it's going to take a few minutes unless you don't have that cold water immersion. The third option is a warm air mist and fanning. It's kind of marginal, but it's better than nothing. So if you've got some mist and some fanning, that will help. But I think for most people, they should at least have the ice water wipes and ice packs available. So those are emergency actions for heat stroke. Some basics on hydration. I mean, just to break it down, some kind of bumper sticker, if you will, tips here for y'all. Drink before you're thirsty. That's a good rule of thumb that I learned when I first started racing my bicycle. If you wait until you're thirsty to drink, it's too late. You've already dehydrated. And I'll talk a little bit about what that means in terms of percentage of dehydration and performance here in a second. Your urine should be nearly clear or light yellow. There's no way for me to give you guys a mathematical recommendation. You need to drink so many glasses of water, so many ounces. I mean, it all varies by person. Everybody is a different weight, different composition. You have different levels of fitness. You have different ambient temperatures, environmental risks out there that vary. So, you know, there is no one mathematical formula I can give you. And the simplest way is just look at your pee. If it's clear or light yellow, you're probably pretty good shape, okay? The idea is that you replace what you remove. If you go into a workout and you lose 4 pounds, you know, you should be replacing most of that with your hydration. You want to find a mixture that tastes good and does a good job hydrating. If it tastes good, you'll drink it. And, of course, you want the composition that hydrates you the best. We'll talk about that in a second. And then cooler is better than room temperature. They found that cooler fluids do a better job at hydrating people. So, again, those are the hydration basics. Trivia. Total body water. What percentage of water is total body weight? Is it 45%, 60%, or 75%? And the answer is 60%. Now, it can range from 45 to 75% because it depends on a person's body composition. Remember, muscle weighs more than fat. It has a higher percentage of water. It's more dense, okay? And everybody here is a little bit different composition. But generally, the percentage of water that is total body weight is about 60%. What happens when you're dehydrated? Here's some dehydration effects. You have decreased blood volume because, remember, the water leaves the blood. That causes the blood to get thick, or the viscosity will change, which increases the heart rate. Now, here's where your fitness comes in. If you're not very fit with your cardiovascular system, what do you think is going to happen? You literally will not be able to keep up with the high heat demands. As your heart rate comes up, it's not going to be able to hang. Okay, so your fitness really matters when it comes to dealing with high heat situations. Another effect of dehydration is you lose your ability to get rid of that heat. Your perceived exertion goes up. So you could perform the same work task dehydrated, and it seems like it's much harder. And your exertion intensity goes down. So you know it feels like it's harder and you're trying to work just as hard, but you can't. So all these things happen when you're dehydrated. None of them are positive, by the way. They're all negative. Let's look at dehydration and performance. Just 1 to 2% dehydration decreases physical performance based on the research that I've heard presented and that I've read. If you've dehydrated 1%, or if you're thirsty, you've already dehydrated 1%. So again, this is why you should drink before you're thirsty, especially as an athlete. But let's look at mental performance. Forget athletics for a minute. Just 1% dehydration decreases mental performance. They did an interesting Division I basketball study on just mental performance, and they found that this 1% dehydration decreased the ability to pay attention, it decreased the ability to focus, and it increased errors in judgment. So from an industrial safety standpoint, you know, I work a lot with industrial companies. If you're dehydrated, it's also affecting your ability to make the proper decisions and the safe decisions. So dehydration is not good. It decreases physical and mental performance. The mental performance decreases, I think, are interesting to note. Accumulative dehydration. This is a carryover effect with consecutive days of working in high heat with poor hydration. So remember, many people follow day one dehydration with more dehydration on day two and day three, especially in a heat wave situation. And then this can lead into a serious heat illness or even death with a heat stroke. So when you go home, you need to really rehydrate, cool down, recover. Remember that sleep deprivation was a big factor in having a heat illness or heat emergency, so make sure to get plenty of rest too. Trivia. Gym dehydration. What percentage of fitness club members are dehydrated during workouts? And that answer is about 40 to 46%. I read two different studies and that was the range. So when people go to the fitness club, they're supposedly quote-unquote exercise-minded people, and about half of them are dehydrated, or close to half, even though they're thinking of health and fitness. So I think the general population actually be much worse than that. I've talked to many people, especially the younger kids, that never drink any water. They drink sodas, they drink energy drinks, but they never drink any plain water. So just plain old water is really healthy for a number of different reasons. Trivia, NBA dehydration, National Basketball Association. These are high-level, world-class athletes. What percentage of dehydration do most NBA players have before the game starts? The answer is 2 to 3%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but remember, 1 to 2% dehydration decreases physical and mental performance. So that's significant, okay, 2 to 3%. Hydration fluids. Let's look at four categories of fluids. Plain water, fitness water, sport drinks, and specialized sport drinks. Plain water is probably going to be fine if you're exercising less than 60 minutes in a low to moderate condition, especially inside where it's air-conditioned or heated and being maintained in a comfortable ambient temperature range. Plain water. Downside of plain water, a lot of people don't like the taste. So if you don't like the taste, you won't drink as much, and therefore you don't hydrate as well. Remember, 40-46% of the people go into the gym dehydrated when they go to exercise. Second category is fitness water. They created fitness water because of the studies that show that adding a little flavor into water promotes more drinking and thus better hydration. So if it has a little bit of flavor, you basically drink more. But be careful. Some of the fitness waters out there have way too many calories. And what you're probably wanting to look for is something with 25 calories or less per bottle. A sport drink is glucose plus electrolytes. This would be something like Gatorade, and there's many other formulations out there and brands. This is high energy for athletes and extremes. Now, there are a lot of people that go to the gym, and they're exercising low to moderate rates for less than 60 minutes in a climate-controlled building, and they're sucking down a Gatorade. So they're not really burning that many calories in a workout. They're probably drinking more calories than they're burning. So, you know, if you're just going into a workout and you're inside of a building, you probably don't need Gatorade. This is developed for football players in Florida that were having heat cramps and heat exhaustion, okay, to get sodium and calories back into their systems. So it's a sport drink for athletes in extreme conditions. And the primary electrolyte in Gatorade, or many of the sport drinks, is sodium. Specialized sport drinks are available now, and they have higher concentrations. And these are really for very extreme conditions like ultra-endurance athletes or super high heat. There are a lot of different compositions now. You have G2 and G3. I can't even keep up with all of them anymore. But basically, the formulations change depending on if it's pre-race, during the event, post-event recovery. You know, you have endurance formulations, and that's what all the different breakdowns are trying to accomplish today. But basically, you have plain water, fitness water, which tends to be fairly low calorie if you get the right one. It has a little bit of flavor. And then sport drink is going to have glucose plus electrolytes. Although the composition can change. Some of them now have fructose as well. Other fluids. When rapid hydration is important, you want to limit these fluids. Sodas. Sodas have a very high sugar content, which delays the gastric emptying process. So even though the soda has water, you can't really process the water because the sugar content is so high. At least get to the water quickly. Remember, we're talking about rapid hydration. So don't drink a soda if you have a heat illness. Something else is going to be a better choice. Fruit juice, same thing. High sugar content delays gastric emptying. Alcohol has a diuretic effect, promoting fluid loss. So don't drink a beer to rehydrate. And then energy drinks, be careful because a lot of them have a lot of caffeine and metabolic stimulants in them. And if you're drinking 4 to 5 cups of coffee a day, that shouldn't be a problem with dehydration, although many people only drink coffee or predominantly coffee, so that might be a problem. But some people are now drinking energy drinks on top of coffee, and I don't think the hard science is out on the energy drinks. Again, an energy drink is not a sport drink. Okay, I'm talking about maybe something like Red Bull or Monster. These types of drinks are not really considered sport drinks. I can tell you what I hear from clients and coaching friends is that they have seen people collapse drinking these things. And again, I'm not saying any brand particular that caused a collapse. I'm just saying energy drinks in general. I'm hearing people go down with these. A lot of them have VTAC, which is a condition that races your heart out of control, so they think they're having a heart attack and they end up having to go to the hospital. Some people combine them with alcohol, so you know, if you think about dehydration, that's a real problem. So just be careful with those. Fluid intake and taste. Studies show that if the temperature of the drink is 59 to 70 degrees, it tastes better, so people will drink more. So again, it's going to be somewhat cool. Also, if it tastes better, people hydrate more. So find something that you like in terms of taste and what works for you. And then a little bit cooler will do a better job rehydrating. Let's look at sweat. Sodium is a primary electrolyte, and it causes cramping if it's low. Sodium also stimulates thirst and helps us to retain water in the body, the sodium is salt. Calcium, not a big player here today with what we're talking about in heat exhaustion, although they've done some interesting studies the last couple of years, and they found that ultra-endurance athletes that have really high sweat rates for year after year after year, many of them have developed osteoporosis, because what they didn't understand until recently was that you lose a lot of calcium in sweat as well. And we're talking about ultra-endurance athletes. I mean, if you don't know what they do, they could do 40 to 100-mile running races. They could be on their bicycle, 3 to 6 hours a day. I mean, these are people that are really out there sweating a lot. It wouldn't be your average athlete. Magnesium, not a major player in the cramps like sodium. And then potassium is not the driver with sweat and cramp problems. It does factor into heart function, but just in terms of looking at the big electrolyte with all the heat illness issues, it's really sodium. But what about bananas? Here's a little trivia. To get enough potassium to prevent heat cramps, you'd have to eat how many bananas? 1, 3, or 5? The answer is just 1, but the banana would have to be 6 feet long and 6 inches in diameter. So while bananas are very healthy, and I like to eat 1 banana a day if I can, it's not going to have a significant factor in you preventing a cramp. So again, sodium is a driver. Now, if you have heart blood pressure issues and you're sodium sensitive, so now we get back into health, right? Your general health is affecting your ability to process the heat and have the right sodium intake, and it gets rather complicated, so make sure to see your doctor on that. But sodium is a big driver with heat illness and cramping. Sweat variables. Sodium concentration. You know, some people are real salty sweaters, and I'm one of them. I when I sweat on my bike helmet or my bike gloves or even a shirt, there can be salt rings in it. So if you're a salty sweater, make sure to put that salt back in your body so you don't thin out that sodium concentration. Your sweat rates vary, by person, gender, conditions. Men tend to sweat more than women. I have a high sweat rate. I'm very efficient at cooling and high temperatures and high exertion levels because I've been trained as an athlete for about 2 decades to do that. The better condition you're in as an athlete, the more you should sweat. You're very efficient at cooling these high core temperatures generated by heavy exertion. Sweat loss, most people lose about 500 to 1,500 milliliters of sweat per hour of vigorous activity. That's about 17 to 50 ounces. I can tell you in the Race Across America that I was putting down up to 2.5 liters per hour, and I was still dehydrating. Okay, so that's a lot of fluid in 1 hour, but the exertion was high, and the sweat rates were high, and so I needed that kind of intake. The highest recorded sweat rate, here's a little sweat rate trivia, is how many liters per hour? 2.5, 3.5, or 5.6 liters per hour? Highest sweat rate recorded was actually 5.6 liters per hour, which is over double probably what I was sweating. Hydration trivia, sweat record. The dehydration record to restore sweat loss is 16 liters. Recorded by a desert marathon runner that lost 33 pounds. So what happened is this guy got lost in a desert marathon. They found him a couple days later. Lost 33 pounds. It took 16 liters to get him back to normal. That's a lot of sweat. Trivia, sweat glands. Human sweat glands actually reabsorb sodium and chloride. True or false? The answer is true. Sweat glands do reabsorb sodium chloride, and what's interesting is being acclimated to heat also improves the body's ability to reabsorb and conserve these valuable electrolytes. So if you're in better shape, your body will hold some of that back that it secretes. Hydration, some performance specifics. Composition, glucose electrolyte solution is optimal, although they're mixing some fructose in now in a certain range, which I'll talk about a little bit in the summary. Concentration for these sport drinks is about 6 to 8%. If you buy it off the shelf, it's probably around 6%, although they have some now that are a little bit stronger, remember, depending on what your activity is and if you're into extreme athletics. Volume, you know, how much should you drink to stay hydrated and rehydrate? Ideally, you replace what you lose, but you should keep the fluid loss to less than 2% of total body weight. So if you weigh 200 pounds and you go into a hard workout and you come back and you weigh 196 pounds, you're within that range, or, you know, right on the bubble. If you weigh 200 pounds, you do a hard workout and you come back in, or a hard day at work and you come back in after work, and you weigh 194 pounds, you've lost way too much fluid in one day. That's not going to be fat loss, that's going to be fluid loss. So you've got to really put that back. Research indicates concerning temperature that 39 degrees Fahrenheit improves exercise capacity compared to hot fluid ingestion. So we talked earlier about the temperature of fluid, you know, helping promote a drinking more and hydration. But in terms of exercise capacity, how much work you can do, if you drink fluid that's pretty cold, I mean, 39 degrees and 32 is freezing, right? It's going to increase exercise capacity. So give you some references on temperature. Ice water is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Cold beer is served from 32 to 57 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on what kind of beer that you like. Hydration, some other complications, diuretics. If you're on a diuretic, it promotes fluid loss. This is something you're taking that causes fluid to leave the body. It can be a prescription drug if you have high blood pressure. So you have to factor that into your ability to maintain proper operating temperature and lose high heat in your core. Caffeine, it's not going to be a major factor if you drink 4 or 5 cups a day. If you start going over that, it could be an issue. Metabolic enhancers, remember, like some of these energy drinks or other supplements that people take, they can raise body temps because they're enhancing the metabolic system, so that means you're creating more heat. If there's a heat wave and you're working really hard, you see all the problems, it kind of, everything exacerbates, or there's a synergistic effect here. So be really careful on supplements and high heat and high exertion. You combine all that in the same day, there could be some problems. And then if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, that promotes fluid loss as well. These are all other complications for hydration. Some rehydration concerns. Proper electrolyte balance during rehydration can prevent hyponatremia. Hyponatremia is water intoxication. Basically, your electrolytes get thinned out. So you don't want to drink a lot of plain water after heat illnesses. And let me break this down a little bit. Hyponatremia, by definition, is extreme electrolyte imbalance due to a low blood sodium or salt that leads to brain swelling and even death. It's usually caused by excessive drinking of plain water in extreme conditions. The U.S. Army did an interesting study. They found other heat illness occurs 20 times more than hyponatremia during physical activity. So when they looked at all the heat illnesses that occur, the U.S. Army, the other ones we talked about earlier in the show occur 20 times more than hyponatremia. So it's not something common, but it can happen. There was a radio contest in California a couple of years ago where they were having people drink a lot of water to win some kind of prize. And the lady that won the prize ended up dying. She drank herself to death. So basically, you can kill yourself by drinking too much water. The electrolytes you have get thinned out, and it can create some brain swelling. It's not good. Some trivia, kids and heat. Children can tolerate heat better than adults, true or false? The answer is false, and it's interesting when you look at children in heat studies. They can produce almost as much heat metabolically as adults, but they don't have a thermoregulatory system as developed. Plus, behaviorally, they're not tuned in like adults to know, hey, I'm overheating, I need to make a cognitive decision to go drink something. So our twins are 5. We have to make them come out of the heat and make them drink. And sometimes they get a little combative about that. But when we finally sit them down and stop them from playing, they'll drink like a fish, you know. So they really did need the drink, but they just won't make that behavioral decision to do so. So remember, kids do not cool as efficiently as adults or have the cognitive awareness to force hydration. Seniors also have a decreased thirst mechanism, so they tend to dehydrate easier. So if you're working with people that are older, or around people older, or caretaking, make sure that they drink. Even though they won't feel like drinking, they need to rehydrate. So in conclusion, before I go into some special athletic updates, you want to acclimate to high heat conditions, and the break-in period is about 4 days. It can take longer, but the first 4 days is very critical to high work intensity and high heat. Stay hydrated, obviously, and not just the first day, but also second, third, fourth day of a heat wave, or let's say the football player is going into double sessions or summer conditioning. Make sure that you're, as soon as practice is over, you're getting ready for the next one. That's what elite athletes do, okay? You're never done. You finish one workout, you're immediately thinking of fuel for and hydration for the next workout so you can maintain efficiency. Watch that carryover dehydration. Know your limits with weight, fitness, and environment. This is a big deal. Remember, your fitness factors into your ability to handle high heat conditions. And humans, we're tropical animals. We adapt well to heat with the right preparation. And, you know, if we're prepared, we'll do quite well. I mean, I've been in the bad water as an official, and I see people running over 100 miles in 125-degree weather. And they didn't die. So if you're prepared, you can do quite well. And then I think the buddy system is important. Take care of each other and watch the warning signs. If you see someone behaving erratically in high heat, that's maybe a sign that there's something going on. Pull them off. So the main presentation is done. I'm going to make a couple points here about hydration and sport updates. There's a new secret weapon called the 2-to-1 sugar mix. And before, we thought that you can only take in about 60 grams of sugar per hour in terms of glucose only uptake. So there are different types of sugar, glucose, fructose, the basic two. But there was some European research done, and they looked at a glucose uptake and fructose uptake. And the theory was is that if they had the right mix, both these uptake systems would work and take total body sugar in at a higher rate. And when they did the research, they found that that was true. So the body has not one, but two sugar uptake mechanisms, both glucose and fructose. So what they found in the research is that by combining these two different types of sugar, you trigger both uptake systems, which brings more overall energy into the body. And how do you mix this? You can actually go to the health food store and buy the ingredients yourself and make it on your own. You don't have to go to the store and buy this pre-made. Here's the formula for the 2-to-1 sugar secret. Take half of a cup of maltodextrin. Okay, that's a type of a pure sugar. 6.5 teaspoons of fructose, and 1/4 to 1/2 teaspoon of table salt. Combine that in 1 liter of water, and you've got something research says will work better than what you can buy off the shelf. So again, it's a 2-to-1 sugar secret formula. You're mixing glucose and fructose, 1/2 cup of maltodextrin, 6.5 teaspoons of fructose, 1/4 to 1/2 teaspoon of table salt, and that's going to depend on if you're a salty sweater or what the ambient conditions are. Some people need a little more salt than others. And combine that in 1 liter of water and shake it up, and there you go. So a little hydration update summary. The 2-to-1 sugar mix is better than straight glucose, okay? And a lot of the commercial formulations now are doing this, and so you'll see this mix of glucose fructose. They've also found that protein in sport drinks optimizes recovery. So a little bit of protein in the sport drink is also a good idea, especially post-event. And new commercial formulations are using both glucose and fructose. More sodium, higher concentrations, and protein to optimize performance. So here's a lot of information today on preventing heat illnesses, hydration for high work conditions or high output at work or athletic work. It doesn't matter. Metabolic work is metabolic work, and it creates a lot of internal core temperature. You need to get rid of that heat by hydrating and sweating and knowing what to wear and knowing what to do after work or after practice to be able to handle day 2, 3, 4, 5 in a succession. So I hope this helps you, and I want you to stay healthy and well in the heat. And you've been listening to Coach RJ Radio. For more info, go to ronjones.org or MySpace/RonJonesFitness. Cool music today provided by my surf guitar friend Laramie Dean. Check him out at LaramieDean.com or MySpace, Laramie Dean Music. Remember, music is good for your health. Tell him Coach RJ sent you. Until next time, get fit, be strong, and keep surfing the endless waves of wellness for optimal health and fitness. Cowabunga!